Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everyone. This is the Wake Up Call, and I'm Richard Martin in Singapore. Well, I'm being asked more and more frequently, with the market that has been just basically going up in a straight line these past few weeks, how much longer it's going to be before the markets recognize the horrific state the world is in today and collapse accordingly. Well, I came across an interesting article by John Maudlin this weekend, which is actually a repeat of one he wrote several years ago, and it contains some excellent nuggets that I'm going to bring you today. There's a book by Mark Buchanan called Ubiquity, Why Catastrophes Happen. It's not directly about investing, although he does touch on it. It's about chaos theory, complexity theory, and critical states. It's written in a manner any layman can understand. There are no equations, just easy to grasp, well-written stories and analogies. As you know from having been a kid and pouring sand onto a pile at the beach, one side eventually started an avalanche. Imagine, Buchanan says, dropping one grain of sand after another onto a table. A pile soon develops. Sooner or later, just one grain starts an avalanche. Most of the time, it's a small one, but sometimes it builds on itself, and it seems like one whole side of the pile slides down to the bottom. In 1987, three physicists named Per Back, Chao Tang, and Kurt Weisenfeld began to play the sandpile game in their lab at Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York. Now, actually piling up one grain of sand at a time is a slow process, so they wrote a computer program to do it. Not as much fun, but a whole lot easier. Not that they really cared about sand piles, they were more interested in what are called non-equilibrium systems. After a huge number of tests with millions of grains of sand, they found that there is no typical number of grains which caused an avalanche. Some involved a large grain, others 10, 100, or 1,000. Still others were pile-wide cataclysms involving millions that brought nearly the whole mountain down. At any time, literally anything, it seemed, might be just about to occur. The piles were indeed completely chaotic in their unpredictability. Quoting Buchanan, "To find out why such unpredictability should show up in their sample game, Back and colleagues next played a trick with their computer. Imagine peering down on the pile from above and coloring it in according to its steepness. Where it is relatively flat and stable, color it green. Where steep and, in avalanche terms, ready to go, color it red. What do you see?" They found that at the outset the pile looked mostly green, but that as the pile grew, the green became infiltrated with ever more red. With more grains, the scattering of red danger spots grew until a dense skeleton of instability ran through the pile. Here, then, was a clue to its peculiar behavior. A grain falling on a red spot can, by domino-like action, cause sliding at other nearby red spots. If the red network was sparse, and all trouble spots were well isolated one from the other, then a single grain could have only limited repercussions. But when the red spots came to riddle the pile, the consequences of the next grain became fiendishly unpredictable. It might trigger only a few tumblings, or it might instead set off a cataclysmic chain reaction involving millions. The sand pile seemed to have configured itself into a hypersensitive and peculiarly unstable condition, in which the next falling grain could trigger a response of any size whatsoever. End of quote. Well, scientists refer to this as a critical state. The term critical state can mean the point at which water would go to ice or steam, or the moment that critical mass induces a nuclear reaction, etc. It's the point at which something triggers a change in the basic nature or character of the object or group. Thus, and very casually for physicists, we refer to something being in a critical state, or use the term critical mass, when there is the opportunity for significant change. Then they wondered whether this phenomenon could show up elsewhere, in the Earth's crust triggering earthquakes, or as wholesale changes in an ecosystem, or as a stock market crash. Could the special organization of the critical state explain why the world at large seems so susceptible to unpredictable upheavals? Could it help us understand not just earthquakes, but why cartoons in a third-rate paper in Denmark could cause worldwide riots? Buchanan concludes in his opening chapter, and I quote, "There are many subtleties and twists in the story, but the basic message, roughly speaking, is simple. The peculiar and exceptionally unstable organization of the critical state does indeed seem to be ubiquitous in our world. Researchers in the past few years have found its mathematical fingerprints in the workings of all the upheavals I've mentioned so far, earthquakes, co-disasters, market crashes, as well as in the spreading of epidemics, the flaring of traffic jams, the patterns by which instructions trickle down from managers to workers in the office, and in many other things. At the heart of our story, then, lies the discovery that networks of things of all kinds, atoms, molecules, species, people, and even ideas, have a marked tendency to organize themselves along similar lines. On the basis of this insight, scientists are finally beginning to fathom what lies behind tumultuous events of all sorts, and to see patterns at work where they have never seen them before." End of quote. In the simplified setting of the sandpile, the power law also points to something else, the surprising conclusion that even the greatest of events have no special or exceptional causes. After all, every avalanche, large or small, starts out the same way. When a single grain falls and makes the pile just slightly too steep at one point, what makes one avalanche much larger than another has nothing to do with its original cause, and nothing to do with some special situation in the pile just before it starts. Rather, it has to do with the perpetually unstable organization of the critical state, which makes it possible for the next grain to trigger an avalanche of any size. Hyman Minsky points out that stability leads to instability. The more comfortable we get with a given condition or trend, the longer it will persist, and then when the trend fails, the more dramatic the correction. The problem with long-term macroeconomic stability is that it tends to produce unstable financial arrangements. If we believe that tomorrow and next year will be the same as last week and last year, we are more willing to add debt or postpone savings in favor of current consumption. Thus, says Minsky, the longer the period of stability, the higher the potential risk for even greater instability when market participants must change their behavior. The longer that a critical state builds up in an economy, or in other words, the more fingers of instability that are allowed to develop a connection to other fingers of stability, the greater the potential for a serious avalanche. As the late Hunt Taylor wrote, and I quote, "Let us start with what we know. First, these markets look nothing like anything I've ever encountered before. Their stunning complexity, the staggering number of tradable instruments and their interconnectedness, the light speed at which information moves, the degree to which the movement of one instrument triggers non-linear reactions along chains of related derivatives, and the requisite level of mathematics necessary to price them, speak to the reality that we are now sailing in uncharted waters. I've had 30-plus years of learning experiences in markets, all of which tell me that technology and telecommunications will not do away with human greed and ignorance. I think we will drive the car faster and faster until something bad happens. And I think it will come, like a comet, from that part of the night sky where we least expect it. This is something old. I think shocks will come, but they will be shallower, shorter. It will be harder to predict, because we are not really managing risk anymore. We are managing uncertainty. Too many new variables, plus leverage on a scale we have never encountered. Something borrowed." End of quote. Another way to think about it is the way Didier Sornet, a French geophysicist, has described financial crashes in his wonderful book, Why Stock Markets Crash. "The specific manner," he wrote, "by which prices collapsed is not the most important problem. A crash occurs because the market has entered an unstable phase, and any small disturbance or process may have triggered the instability. The collapse is fundamentally due to the unstable position. The instantaneous cause of the collapse is secondary." End of quote. So when things are unstable, it isn't the last grain of sand that causes the pile to collapse, or the slight breeze that causes the ruler on your fingertip to fall. Those are the proximate causes. They're the closest reasons at hand for the collapse. The real reason, though, is the remote cause, the furthest reason. The furthest reason is the underlying instability of the system itself. A fundamentally unstable system is exactly what we saw in the recent credit crisis. Consumers all through the world's largest economies borrowed money for all sorts of things because times were good. Home prices would always go up, and the stock market was back to its old trick of making 15% a year. And borrowing money was relatively cheap. You could get 2% short-term loans on homes, which seemingly rose in value 15% a year. So why not buy now and sell a few years down the road? Greed took over. Those risky loans were sold to investors by the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars all over the world. And as with all debt sandpiles, the fault lines started to appear. Maybe it wasn't that one loan in Las Vegas that was the critical piece of sand. We don't know. But the avalanche was triggered. I was talking about these problems with subprime debt here on the show in 2005 and 2006. Some of you will remember. But as the problem actually emerged, respected people like Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Fed, said that the problem was not all that big and that the fallout would be contained. But of course it wasn't contained. It caused banks to realize that what they thought was AAA credit was actually a total loss. And as banks looked at what was on their books, they wondered about their fellow banks. How bad were they? Who knew? Since no one did, they stopped lending to each other. Credit simply froze. They stopped taking each other's letters of credit, and that hurt world trade. Because banks were losing money, they stopped lending to smaller businesses. Commercial paper dried up. All those so-called safe, off-balance sheet funds and banks created were now folding. What Paul McCulley first labeled as the shadow banking system. Everyone sold what they could, not what they wanted to cover their debts. It was a true panic. Businesses started laying off people who in turn stopped spending as much. The buildup of critical states is perpetuated as we hedge risks. We try to stabilize the risks we see, shoring them up with derivatives, emergency plans, insurance, and all manner of risk control procedures which allows the economic system to absorb body blows that would have been severe only a few decades ago. We distribute the risks and the effects of the risk throughout the system. Yet, as we reduce the known risks, we sow the seeds for the next 10 sigma event. It creates invisible risks, which will create the next real crisis. The longer we patch things up in this way, the more likely and violent an avalanche becomes. The more the fingers of instability can build. The more that state of stable disequilibrium can go critical on us. We saw this in 1997. Thailand began to experience trouble. The debt explosion in Asia began to unravel. Russia was defaulting on its bonds. Now, Russia is awash in capital. Who could anticipate such a dramatic turn of events? Things on the periphery, small fingers of instability, began to impinge on fault lines in the major world economies. Something that had not been seen before happened. The historically sound and logical relationship between 29 and 30-year bonds broke down. Then country after country suddenly and inexplicably saw that relationship in their bonds begin to correlate, an unheard-of event. A diversified pool of debt was suddenly no longer diversified. And then came the debacle with long-term capital management. All right, ladies and gentlemen, very quickly, my information, starting with the toll-free number, which is 888-874-4888. Once more, toll-free number, it's all yours. Go ahead, put your fingers in there, dial it up, 888-874-4888. Then we have my email address. For those of you who would prefer to do things that way, you may. And the email address is rm@gfawd.com. RM stands for Richard Martin, amazingly enough. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Let me give it to you once more. rm@gfawd.com. And then my direct line for those of you interested in talking to me about your personal financial situations, Please don't hesitate. Call me any time of the day or night. I am usually available. The number is 941-441-1682. 941-441-1682. Just please don't call me at 2 a.m. Singapore time next Monday, Friday, because then I will be speaking to you live on the wake-up call. So don't have any bright ideas of calling me at 2 a.m. in the morning. It just won't work. All right. Well, we're getting dangerously close to the next meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That is next Sunday, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is within earshot. That will be next Sunday at 2 p.m., the 26th of August, at the George Street Ale House in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And for those of you who have never been in New Brunswick, it's exactly halfway between New York and Philadelphia, and it is on the way to Washington, D.C. So come by train. It is within a stone's throw of the station, or by car, plentiful parking available for all. At that meeting, we will have two people from the Guatemala seminar of from Johnny Miller, who will be talking about their experiences, recollections, feelings about living in Latin America. Well worthwhile, ladies and gentlemen. That is the thrust of our meetup group, is the idea that some of you will want to know why it's important to leave and will want to know how to do so. And I have given my full blessing to what comes out of that meeting, because I know that people will get a lot of moral courage from the meetings. I've been given a lot of feedback in the past about these. Absolutely essential for you to know how this works. It will make it much easier. It will smooth the path for you. So please, please feel free to call Jack for details. Jack Trevesta, his number is 914-414-6940. He will give you directions, he will tell you what's going to happen, and he will take your name so that he can configure the room in the restaurant for the company present. Again, that's Jack. Please call him, 914-414-6940, to let him know you are coming. And do go, ladies and gentlemen. It will be an interesting experience. Even those who have been before, please go to help the new ones get accustomed to this idea that we really need to be considering a move away from the United States sometime in the near future. All right. Well, we have a long way to go with this deleveraging process that's happening in the economies of the world right now. It'll take many years for this particular sand pile to complete its collapse. You know, you can't borrow your way out of a debt crisis, whether you are a family or a nation. And as too many families are finding out today, if you lose your job, you can lose your home. People who were once very creditworthy are now filing for bankruptcy and walking away from homes. All those subprime loans going bad put huge numbers of homes back onto the market, which caused prices to fall on all homes, which in turn caused an entire home construction industry to collapse, which hurt all sorts of ancillary businesses, which again caused more people to lose their homes and give up their homes, and on and on and on. The connections in the housing part of the sand pile were long and deep. It is all connected. We built a very unstable sand pile, and it came crashing down, and now we have to dig out from the problem. And the problem, ladies and gentlemen, was too much debt. It will take years as banks write off home loans and commercial real estate and more, and we get down to a more reasonable level of debt. as a country and as a world. Bond markets require confidence above all else. If and when Greece defaults, then how far away is Spain or Japan? We now see that Spain is not all that far. And then, as I always ask, the question comes down as sure as night follows day. What makes the United States so different if America doesn't control its debts? As Reinhardt and Rogoff show, when confidence goes, the end is very near. And it always comes faster than anyone expects. Bang, there goes that sandpile. The global financial system is all connected. Tiny Greece and now larger Spain, but soon Italy and even France, can make a huge difference in places far removed from Europe, just as America's subprime debt created a crisis all over the world. The world financial system allowed too much risk to be taken on, and then spread that risk far and wide through fancy new financial engineering and securitizations. Many investors and pension funds thought that by buying a lot of different types of securities, they were diversifying their risk, when in fact, the same connected risk ran through almost everything. Investments that are normally not correlated will again show a high degree of correlation, as they did during the recent crisis, just when we need that diversification of risk to help us. There is no reason to think it will be all that much different in the next crisis period, which is almost upon us. Investing is not easy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, we're almost at the halfway mark. I think we should take a break here, and I will be right back. Okay, I think we're back. And just a quick reminder, please, ladies and gentlemen, that as of September, my show will be coming to you live at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. 2 p.m. on Mondays and Fridays. I think that Labor Day will be a holiday. I haven't squared it off with Matt if he's listening and wants to put in a yes or no here. I will be able to confirm that, but certainly as from the beginning of September we will be Matt says maybe, but we will be coming to you at 2 p.m. so please note that in your diaries. All right, we have Bill from Georgia who would like to talk about gold and essential banks. Hello, Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, Richard, another gold question for you, sorry about this. What's the deal with the central banks buying up gold? China, Russia, India, you know, countries are just buying up gold. Soros is buying up gold, other people. What's the deal with all that?
First of all, I don't know how anybody actually knows that these central banks are buying gold. I've read the same thing as you, Bill, as a matter of fact. So, you know, I read it and I kind of put it in my brain and then move on. It doesn't really make much difference as far as I'm concerned. The purchase of gold involves the sale of gold. And in those kinds of large quantities, which they would have to be pretty large quantities, you're going to find that the transactions take place at the London fixing because they're so huge that the quantities couldn't be set off in the regular markets, the futures markets. So it's not going to have that much of an effect on the price of gold. All it's really going to do is to reposition the gold from, you know, one venue to another. I don't think it makes much difference. I do think that it's very possible that they are buying gold because, quite frankly, they tend to do the wrong thing at the wrong time. When gold was trading at $250, $275 back in 2000, 2001, Britain famously sold off its entire stock of gold right at the bottom, just before, you know, an 800% rise in the price of gold. Brilliant move, Britain. Let's have more of it. no, I mean, seriously, I don't think it's a really significant event, Bill.
You don't think they're trying to back up the fiat currency?
No. No, because they believe in the fiat currency. They don't, see, these central banks don't believe in gold. They believe in fiat currency. That's why we have it. If they didn't believe in the fiat currency, they'd go back on the gold standard, wouldn't they?
Well, I was wondering if maybe they see something that maybe they're worried about the fiat currency.
Everybody's worried. I mean, listen, you can't lose that much buying power in your own currency and not be concerned. I mean, that's very obvious. But paradoxically, these days, it's the assets that are losing value rather than the currency. So I don't think that, as I talk about inflation, I don't think that we're losing that much value right now. I think we will in the future, and we certainly have in the past. But, you know, the central banks are fairly relaxed about this now. You know, with interest rates, short-term interest rates at 0%, they really don't have much to worry about.
And you don't foresee like situations like, you know, in the past, like with Argentina and hyperinflation, you don't see that.
Nope, I don't. I've explained it quite frequently on the show.
Yes, I know you have, and I appreciate that.
I don't foresee hyperinflation simply because there is no demand for goods and services. See, if wages and salaries were going up, then the whole thing would be very different. But really, we're looking at a consumer base which is entirely tapped out. And therefore, where does the inflation come from? I always ask the question, you know, where, if you, we have this tragic drought in the States right now, which is pushing the price of grain sky high, but that's not inflation. That's a very clear, exceptional situation which engenders the rise in the price of grains. But that's not inflation. It's not the same thing. Inflation is not per se a rise in the price of things. It's a function of the supply of money and the money relationship to goods and services. And that's not calling for inflation right now, Bill.
Okay. And I guess one last thing would be, there's, what about the angle that people in general would lose faith in paper and think that, well, you know, we've kind of figured it out, it's just paper, we're losing faith in it, and therefore it's worth less, and that would give rise to hyperinflation?
Well, the argument doesn't really go that way, does it? I mean, if they lose faith in paper, it really requires that they have the ability to take steps in order to rectify the situation. Unfortunately, people today don't have any ability to take any steps. They're losing jobs, they're losing homes. What can they do if they see the value of their currency falling, either in buying power or in relation to another currency? There's really nothing that they can do. I mean, yes, they can. They can rise up and basically engage in civil unrest and violence, which I think is coming. It's certainly there in Greece and Spain. We're seeing that right now. But it isn't because they really are losing faith in paper. It's because they're losing faith in a system which doesn't give them jobs and homes. And that's enough, you know, for anybody to want to riot and cause unrest. So I wouldn't, you know, I think we're looking at the wrong problem, Bill, that's all. I think we're looking at something which is a meaningless concept. I don't know why everybody is so keen. And I do think that it's helpful for the powers that be to have everybody obsessing over the price of, you know, gold and the price of the dollar and the price of currencies and the value and all this, because it takes their minds off the reality of their own wretched situation, which is, you know, losing jobs and losing homes. And so it's quite convenient for governments to have the populists think that way, but I don't think you should be thinking that way. I think you should be looking at all sorts of other things.
Okay. My friend, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Bill. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of emails, so I think I'm going to plunge right in and take one from Mick Russell, who says, Richard, I know you don't do politics, but a FYI, for your information, for you on possible upcoming violence. The so-called Arab Spring has been a great success. Most are happy the dictators are no longer in office, so let's party. Let the crucifixions begin. The religion of peace is ramping up to a cleansing in Egypt. If the world tolerates this brutality, it may have to apologize to its actions against other thugs and butchers of the past. Mick Russell. Thank you, Mick. Interesting comment. Then comes one from Steve Walsh, who says, Hi, Richard. I wanted to take a moment and write to thank you for all your encouragement via the wake-up call regarding relocating from the USA. I just received my first six-month visa for the Czech Republic. I've been coming here for a couple of years and love the country. I have made some great friends, and my girlfriend, who is Czech, lives here. The paperwork for the visa was not that difficult to apply for, and I am now able to work here legally. The language is not easy, but people commonly speak English. The culture, nature, and atmosphere are amazing. There seems to be a healthy balance between work, family, friends, and relaxation. Also, people are generally more in touch with nature and are much more self-resilient with everything from growing your own food to basic skills passed down from generation to generation. Ironically, living in a former communist country feels much more free than life in the USA. Thank you, in caps, again, for your great show. Best, Steve Walsh. And then one from AK, who says, Hello, Richard. I am a recent convert to your show and listen faithfully twice every week. I find myself having many conversations lately with friends and family where I insist they are crazy to want to buy property, or any asset for that matter, due to the coming implosion of prices. I would appreciate a rant or some ammunition to bolster my arguments. In this I mean, time permitting of course, what is the actual mechanism of deflation? How exactly do millions of homes in shadow inventory really affect things? And while I am somewhat aware of the signs of it, the ability to put the argument together in a somewhat vain attempt to save my circle of friends from themselves would be appreciated. Thanks, and keep up the amazing work of helping those like us see through the smoke of the pundits to the underlying fire. A.K. A.K., I have talked a lot about deflation, and I'd actually, you know, love to talk again about it, but I think the listeners have heard a very great deal about that from me, so, you know, my time is fairly limited on the show, and so this is what I'm going to suggest you do. If you go to the archives, I write up every week after the show a summary, a précis of what I've talked about, and what I think you should do is scroll through the archives until you find one which talks about deflation and something I may have said about deflation, and then just go into the recording, into the actual the sound archive and listen to it and see if you can pick something up from that. Failing that, if it really doesn't work, write to me again or call me, and I'll talk to you for a few minutes about that. But fortunately, PRN provides us with a facility whereby we can actually write a little précis of what we talk about on our shows. And each time I talk about some particular subject, I put it into the archives. So you will find stuff about deflation. And failing that, as I say, give me a call, and we'll chat about it on the show for a while. Okay. Good. Well, let us go to another email. This one comes from Anonymous, who says, Hi, Richard. Wake Up Call has become a regular part of my weekly podcast listening education. Thank you for your efforts as a voice in the wilderness. They are appreciated. I'm in my late 40s. I became disabled after 20 years in the U.S. corporate world and am currently receiving Social Security disability. 7 years ago, I earned a master's degree and still owe $40,000 in student loans. This is my only debt. I have slightly more than $40,000 in a UBS managed account left over from the days when I had a lot more wealth. I also have a small 401k and other accounts amounting to about $30,000. My earning potential is compromised. The thought of cashing out the managed account scares me, but less than having this student loan debt hanging over my head. The anecdotal stories of people who've fallen into the tender mercies of Sallie Mae are enough to scare anyone. I discussed this with my financial advisor in February and then more strongly in April. He believes that the 2.9% fixed rate of the student loan makes it a no-brainer to keep. He's an old family friend and giving advice he would follow himself. Should I free myself from debt? Your thoughts on this question may be helpful, not only to me, but also to others who are in similar situations. With sincere best wishes, Anon. Well, Anon, very quickly to cut to the chase, yes, get rid of that $40,000, get it out of the UBS managed account, and pay it off. Do not pay 2.9% as a gift to Sallie Mae every month, every year. It is pointless. It is completely unnecessary. You have the money, pay it off. And I say this, obviously, as I would say about any loan, but particularly about student loans, because they are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. And trust me, they will hound you for this money for the rest of all time. So you need to get rid of it. Yes, please do that. That's pretty much all I have to say on the subject. But let me just say about loans in general that each of you really has to make a decision, especially if they're housing loans, as to what you want to do. 60 Minutes once called it a business decision to walk away from loans. You have to decide for yourselves whether that is an ethical thing to do, whether it's something that will catch up with you maybe in the future. Yes, of course, it will ding your credit, but then most people aren't really using credit these days, so I don't know how important that is. But in general, ladies and gentlemen, one way or another, you must get rid of your debts, because otherwise you will be in indentured servitude to the banks for years to come. And that is overall my advice to you. Get rid of your debts. Okay? So, Mahmoud Masood comes in with an email. Dear Richard, where does Germany get its money from? They must be printing their own money to stay debt-free. How has the ECB allowed them to be debt-free? Isn't the ECB the Fed of Europe? Thanks. Masood, I'm glad you wrote that email because I think it clears up something I may not have mentioned in the past, which is that, you know, you have credit-a-nations and definitions. A definition would be a Greece or a Spain or an Italy or a Portugal, and a credit-a-nation would be a Germany, a Holland, a Finland. Basically, it tends to divide along north-south parameters in Europe. The northern countries are usually the successful ones, and the southern ones are the ones that have overreached. But of course, one of the important things to understand is that neither Germany nor any other country can print money like the United States, because the euro is a common currency to all these countries, and that, of course, is one of the horrors of the southern European countries. They're used to printing money. They're used to rampant inflation to bring themselves into some form of competitive economic relationship with the rest of Europe. They can't do this. They are now locked into a currency where whatever they can do, they cannot print money. Now, this, of course, is true of the rich countries as well as the poorer ones. So, Masood, the way Germany makes its money is very simply by selling to other countries more than the other countries sell to it. Therefore, it builds up a surplus of money in in the banks, and that is where their money comes from, as it were, where the extra money that you talk about is generated. Now, the ECB doesn't, as it were, allow them to be debt-free. The ECB doesn't have any power over the fiscal future of any of these countries. They just stand by, you know, waiting to deal with the financial situation much in the same way that the Fed would do in the United States. So hopefully that's cleared up the questions there, Masood, and so we shall move on to Gilbert's question, Gilbert Pisinich, who says, "Dear Richard, to deal with the extraordinary federal debt before we default, we can downsize the three branches of the U.S. government. They were originally created to provide a system of checks and balances, which, as we now see, is a miserable failure. I suggest that the threat of job loss, along with lifetime health benefits and retirement, might inspire a few of our esteemed few public servants to honor the oath they took upon their appointment. They swore to serve the public good, meaning the citizenry of the U.S., not the interests of international corporations and international banks. Let's cut the Senate to one senator per state, the Congress by half, and in the executive branch we can eliminate the position of vice president. It could be replaced by a cardboard cutout and a mechanical waving hand. Nobody will know the difference. Regards, Gilbert." Thank you, Gilbert. That sounds to me like an email from our good friend Steve. But it isn't. Gilbert is his own man, and he's written his own email. So thank you, Gilbert. That's very nice of you. Appreciate that. All right. Well, let's just have a quick look at what was behind the meltdown of the financial crisis 4 years ago. The concept of too big to fail fits conveniently into the media's script, and as a result, it simply won't go away. In the past few years, the news hour theme has been the small taxpayer versus the gargantuan evildoer banks. And since the banks are the big bad guys, wouldn't it be great to make them smaller so that their mistakes can't crash the whole economy again? After all, this is all their fault, right? Well, at first blush, a bank breakup seems like a reasonable solution. But think about what's being assumed here. The assumption is that a few greedy major banks with their poor and sometimes outright foolish decisions are responsible for a multi-year global recession. However, think about it. Is this really how things actually happened? Of course, except for one part, it wasn't just a few banks and they weren't all big. Too big to fail would make sense if the crisis was caused simply by Lehman Brothers or Wachovia, but it wasn't. Every single major U.S. bank was running for cover. Some were in better shape than others, but no one walked out from the mortgage bubble unscathed. Furthermore, Wall Street banks weren't the only ones in trouble. Though not as highly publicized, smaller banks were playing the same dangerous game with real estate. Check out the FDIC's list of failed banks. You'll find very few household names on it. Additionally, there are 772 troubled banks on the FDIC's problem bank list. After subtracting the big boys from that number, you'll still have about 750 small banks on that list. But there's even more to it. Not only were both big and small banks participants in the bubble, so were banks in Europe and elsewhere around the globe. If the banks weren't making toxic loans themselves, they were knee-deep in mortgage-backed securities holding the same debt. And as a result, when things had really hit the fan, no major financial institution anywhere in the world was left blameless. Ultimately, the size of an institution didn't really matter, because the shock was systemic, affecting every bank, big and small, local and international. The 2008 crash simply wasn't the result of a single large bank crashing, but rather a whole system. when everyone had the same bad incentives, you get bad behavior across the board. In fact, when the problem is systemic, a bank's size has little relevance to the overall crisis. For example, in the 1980s, savings and loan crisis, we had the exact opposite of too big to fail. Many small banks got themselves into trouble, causing a nationwide economic problem. So how do these problems happen all at once? Unless we look to systemic causes, the explanations can get pretty weird. Maybe there's a black-robed conspiratorial group of bank presidents and CEOs, ranging from small community bank leaders to major overseas corporations, which is responsible for all this. But somehow, I doubt it. Let's not also forget about the small investors flipping houses and the people taking oversized loans as part of this story as well. Were these guys also in on the conspiracy? The more likely explanation is that everyone simultaneously faced poor incentives. So now we come to the real question, which never seems to get asked. What caused these negative systemic incentives? Ah, must be the U.S. government, right? Well, certainly the federal government does set many incentives and regulations, but that doesn't explain the nature of the global meltdown. Some policies, such as the Community Reinvestment Act, didn't help, but many countries around the world have dumb laws and regulations. But the effects of poor domestic regulation rarely spill over on such a massive global scale. Perhaps laws and regulations can explain the slow U.S. recovery, but they can't explain why the entire world went into a meltdown. We have to look one layer deeper at the problem. Though the U.S. government is huge, the federal government is the only institution which can truly influence the whole global marketplace. When the Fed brings interest rates down, it affects rates and markets around the world. U.S. treasuries are considered risk-free assets and hence are the benchmark for every other investment in the world. Furthermore, when the Fed pumps money into the system to keep rates low, some of that money will spill overseas as well. It doesn't stay contained to the U.S. So here, finally, we have the culprit. The Federal Reserve does have the capability of causing a worldwide crisis. Lehman Brothers was a big investment bank, but at the end of the day, its demise wasn't so huge as to warrant a 4-year-long recession. Furthermore, the failure of single financial institutions hardly causes recession. MS Global failed a few months back, and the market has kept on moving. What really caused worldwide bad incentives was the low-rate policy of the Federal Reserve. With rates held low for an excessively long period of time, cheap money flooded the system. And these funds fueled speculative and riskier investments in search of greater returns. The same thing is going on today with your average investor. People are flooding into junk bonds in search of yield. The Fed, with its near zero rate policy and cheap money, pushes people into riskier and riskier assets. Everyone faces this incentive simultaneously, regardless of whether you're a Bank of America, the local hometown bank, or just an average guy buying a house. When a single big institution fails, the whole world can go down in flames as well. However, that institution has to be much bigger than the Lehmans, Wachovias, and AIGs of the world. It is the Federal Reserve. And almost no steps are being made to limit its powers or make it smaller. Unfortunately, this institution will continue to create bad incentives which guide banks, large and small, local and international, right off the cliff. The Fed's suppression of interest rates is just one example of just how intrusive the government has become in the market. Coupled with gargantuan sovereign debts, ever-increasing business regulations, and escalating taxes, the world economy is so heavily politicized that all the roadmaps investors have used to guide their portfolios have been altered beyond recognition. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are almost at the end of yet another show, and it has been a pleasure to talk to you, and I think we should finish appropriately with a banker joke. One night at a bar, a conventioneer sits down next to an attractive woman and orders a drink. The woman, apparently having already downed a few drinks, turns around, faces him, looks him straight in the eye and says, "Listen here, good-looking, I screw anybody, anytime, anywhere, your place, my place, in the car, front door, back door, on the ground, standing up, sitting down, naked, or with clothes on. It doesn't matter to me, I just love it." Eyes now wide with interest, he responds, "No kidding, I'm in banking too." Well, what's the problem with banker jokes? Bankers don't think they're funny. Normal people don't think they're jokes. Okay, guys, have a great week. I'll be back on Friday with more of the same. Take care. Bye-bye.